was in Representative Catherine's office entertaining some other folks up there on some other budget issues. So Representative Patrick will be a few minutes late, and I understand Senator Devlin's called down, and he'll be just a few minutes late as well. We were in the process of working on the in the Department of Administrative Services House Bill 5002, specifically with regard to the comptroller. And let me just say this: we're gonna ask that all of the slides be sped up considerably, recognizing that the slides all are within the books that are present. And we're gonna see if we can't move through this much more rapidly so that we can get actually to the numbers and crunch the numbers as soon as we possibly can and start taking a look at those things. So we're gonna move to the Reader's Digest version. John, please go ahead and identify yourself for the record. Again, Karen Segris is our clerk today, and from the Legislative Fiscal Office, Dallas Wyand. Please proceed.
Okay, for the record, my name is John Radford, Administrator of the State Controllers Division, Department of Administrative Services. And I believe when we last met, we left off on this particular slide, and this particular slide. Well, before I start, let me tell you, I did pass out. We do have copies of our travel policy. That was an issue last time we met, and so you have a copy before you of our travel policies. And the other document we handed out is kind of a comprehensive report on the issues that we were discussing last week on accounts receivable. So you have that document before you. On this particular slide, this is about where we left off last week, interagency, intergovernmental kinds of services, and I won't spend a lot of time on this slide because we kind of covered six FTE that we have in our organization that is providing governmental accounting, financial reporting, and budgeting services to those 26 small agencies. So that's basically our intergovernmental kind of program slide. The next slide is administrative cost controls, and I'll just mention a couple things here. I talked a little bit last week about our data mart and how that services informational reporting needs of the agencies. I'll mention the ACH. ACH stands really as an acronym for Automated Clearinghouse. That's a program of direct deposit. You're familiar with that kind of a program on your paychecks. We took the ACH functionality and broadened it to include vendor payments. So we're in the process now of allowing vendors to register with us. They'll be able to get electronic disbursements. They'll also be able to log into a website and get their remittance or invoice information. And so we pretty much eliminated all paper processing there. We've already spent considerable time on travel cards, so I won't spend any more time on that. We're also working on continuously on ways to automate and eliminate manual processes, and that's, for example, we've just implemented a new automated reconciliation routine that's going to help us save time and effort. So those are the kinds of administrative cost controls that we've implemented. Those are mostly internal. The next slide looks at external administrative cost controls, and I'll just mention a couple here. We do have a new contract for accounts receivable collection. We went from 8 vendors to some 11 vendors now, and so that's kind of an improvement. We've also implemented new controls on our e-commerce project. One that you might be interested here is we've got an accounts payable cost recovery contract that we're just in the beginning stages of implementing. This is a national firm that we've hired to come in and take a look at a couple years' worth of history of accounts payable, and they've been successful at recovering some costs from accounts payable transactions. For example, there could be duplications of costs, duplicate payments made. There could be payments made in error, and we've hired them to go through our accounts payable data to see if they can extract any cost recoveries there. They'll be working over the next 6 months with us on that project. With that, I'm going to turn it over to budget management to talk a little bit about our budget.
Okay. Thank you, John. For the record, Cora Parker from the Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management Division. You should have a separate copy of a PowerPoint presentation. We won't be showing slides on the wall here. You'll have to look at your paper copy. I'll start out just with an overview of the governor's budget for the State Controller's Division. About $25.2 million total funds for 0305. This is a 0.2% increase from the fifth special session, or the legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The growth you see actually 11.8% in the limited other funds category and a reduction of 5.4% in the non-limited category. Also, two limited duration positions were eliminated, and those related to the original e-commerce positions that were approved. And we'll talk about policy package related to those in a few moments. The second slide just briefly shows the split of funding for the division. The bulk of funds is in the other funds and unlimited category, but it's a fairly reasonable split between the two. State Controller's division budget is just a 0.2% increase from, again, the legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. The budget continues core functions, and it continues support for statewide e-commerce activities, although at a somewhat reduced level from the current biennium. The following slide, and again, I apologize for moving so quickly. Feel free to stop me at any time if you have questions. But the following slide just shows the split of the $25.2 million total funds in the State Controller's Division budget. Approximately 59% for services and supplies, about 30% for personal services costs, and then another 11% for debt service. In creating the governor's budget, we began with a $24.8 million level related to the 2001-03 legislatively adopted budget. Legislatively approved actions through April 2002 included an increase of just about $92,000. That included emergency board approval of the electronic commerce positions, and it also included offsetting reductions related to the second special session. Would you like me to wait until you have...
Let's see, Corey, you're in the handout right now, which is State Controller's Division handout.
Correct.
I just had one quick question.
Sure.
Relative to the 11% debt service, what debt service is being controlled out of the State Controller's Division?
I believe those are COPs that were issued some years ago for the RSTAR system.
Yes. RSTAR?
It's basically the main state accounting system. Does everyone have a copy now? Okay. Again, through April 2002, an increase of about $92,000. That included both e-board approvals and reductions related to the special session, the second special session. Base budget adjustments included the roll-up of 2001-03 position actions and compensation changes, and as I mentioned earlier, the elimination of limited duration positions related to the e-commerce program. Essential packages, which the division will talk about in somewhat more detail, included just a $300,000 increase in total funds. The State Controller's Division has one policy package, Package 338, again, related to electronic commerce. The total cost is just under $80,000 other funds, and effectively it changes one accountant one position to an accountant four position. Originally, there were three positions in the 0103 biennium, and they actually eliminated a couple positions, said we can do this with one position if we restructure it somewhat, and so that's what you'll see in this package.
So an accountant four makes $80,000 more in a biennium than an accountant one?
Mr. Chair, not necessarily. This is all costs associated with the position, so it includes salary, it includes purse costs, other compensation costs, and there's also, I believe, maybe a small service and supplies amount related to this position as well.
Okay.
And just a brief overview related to assessments and fees. The Controller's Division decreased assessment charges from $17.8 million in the current biennium to $14.7 million in the governor's proposed budget, and service charges increased from $4.9 million to approximately $6 million. And as you'll see on all the slides related to DAS and actually every agency that you have before you, there will be some technical adjustments that we'll ultimately need to work through related to the salary freeze and other position-related actions if, in fact, you choose to use those proposals. That is a very quick overview.
Okay, are there questions for Ms. Parker relative to the presentation? Okay. We continue to hear. I think that does it then for the Comptroller's Division at this particular point.
Representative Butler, we do have a few additional slides that.
Okay, and back into the book. Okay. Go ahead, John.
The next slide addresses growth and reductions for our division. And as Cora mentioned, we have just the elimination of two limited duration e-commerce positions included in our budget. The next slide covers essential packages. The first is a $19,500 adjustment on personal service adjustments. It's mostly related to 3.5% non-fixed personal service item increases. And then we have an inflation adjustment of $208,000, which is mostly the 3.5% inflation for goods and service factors, and then price list adjustments for state government service charges. That covers that. Next slide is a program adjustment of $92,000, limited duration position in e-commerce, which was eliminated. The addition of the governor's reduced travel expenses of $17,500, and then restores one-time administrative reductions from the second special session of $99,000. So those are the kinds of adjustments that we've provided for in the budget.
Where was the $99,000 efficiency eventually applied, John?
Those were delayed purchases of equipment. We have some, obviously we have personal computers and somewhat of a schedule. And what we did was just lengthen the purchase schedule on those to hold them in our office before longer time than our normal replacement schedule would take place. We've reduced some national dues, and we had some projected savings in office supplies and tried to generate some savings in some other line items.
So in effect, the $99,000 one-time administrative efficiency is really going to have to catch up with us now.
We're going to have to catch up eventually, right. I've got some equipment that we're starting to think about even cannibalizing, so we need to. In future years, we're going to have to replace that equipment.
Okay, I've got a list that I'm going to be giving to Representative Patridge in his capacity as chairman of the public safety, and one of the questions that we'll be asking there will be information relative to association dues and affiliations, who travels, and who are members, who benefits from that travel, who assigns the travel to be made, and how is that selection made. So those will be some questions that we'll be asking. I'll get that list updated for the general government. I've been working on it more for the public safety than I have for the general government to make sure that Representative Patridge has the benefit of my thinking, and I have the benefit of his. So with that, we will ask some questions relative to that a little bit later on. Please proceed.
Okay, the enhancement package, as Cora mentioned, reclasses the accountant 1 to accountant 4. And what we found when we got into the program is that the level of complexity that we're dealing with on the e-commerce and the interface between the e-commerce application and our accounting system is going to require a higher level seasoned veteran knowledge to accommodate that change. So this we're increasing the accountant 1 to an accountant 4.
There's a difference of about $3,000 from $76,678, $79,678. $3,000 difference in the two numbers that are produced there.
Mr. Chair, I'll look into that tonight.
All right, thank you very much. And then I would like the breakdown of, you know, reclassing an account from 1 to 4 having a cost of $76,000, including any additional S&S and so forth.
Mr. Chair, you'd like to see basically what the components are.
Right, and Dallas said that he has it here. I would like to know what the difference is in relative to the overall position. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
The next slide.
I'm sorry, Senator Winters, recognized, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. You talked about the equipment acquisition. What is the schedule? How much time? What's the time that we use on equipment? Let's say, like computers and desks, and before they're sent to facilities.
Chair Butler and Senator Winters, members of the committee. The schedule we have varies based on usage of that equipment and how much activity there is on pieces of equipment. For example, most of our staff have got personal computers, and we're running those right now between three and a half to 4.5 years on those. On our printers, we've had printers in there for as long as 5 to 7 years, and sometimes they get high volume usage. We've got one microfiche reader printer that is about 7 or 8 years old, and the company is no longer supporting that model, that maker model. And so those are the kinds of length of time that we're keeping that equipment. and then we schedule replacement as we go.
Is the agency credited with when the equipment is sold?
Chair Butler and Senator Winters, yes. The use, if there's any useful utility in that equipment that can be obtained, we'll turn that equipment over to surplus and surplus sells it.
So that when surplus sells it, how are the dollars then?
Those dollars go back into our budget.
Into your budget, but not the agency's budget.
Well, the agency's budget goes back into, it goes back in as a small cash contribution into other funds, or goes back into the agency's budget.
I was out to surplus just recently, and they're pretty much stacked for computers and things, pretty much stacked to the rafters, and they're getting truckloads in almost daily from agencies, and that was why I raised this question. In this kind of environment, how long are we hanging on to equipment and making sure that we don't need to buy new equipment when the old will do just as well? Because I understand there was some relatively new equipment out there when I went out to look at it. Not computers, but desks and whatever.
Thank you.
On our budget note slide, I'll mention a couple of things. We talked a little bit about improved controls on state credit cards, improved controls on electronic commerce. On the advocacy side, we did make a April 2002 presentation to the emergency board on methodologies that we've implemented to improve oversight and training with those advocacy commissions. We implemented new policy and procedures, implemented training. All boards and commission chairs have received or executive agency heads have received one-day training. Covers a wide variety of administrative requirements. In terms of the Department of Justice cash flow issue, that was presentation was made by DOJ to the emergency board in November 2002 board meeting, and they came in and provided all of the improvements that they had made over the past year to improve cash flow collections. Primarily an advanced payment system was implemented, and then they also improved billing procedures and information flows to the agency to resolve billing issues. On the next slide, audits slide, we have no audit findings to report from the recent Federal Compliance and Internal Control Report, and the last two financial statements received a clean opinion from the Audits Division.
Clean opinion, no management letter.
Pardon me?
Clean opinion, no management letter.
I don't believe we had a management letter that had any topics or issues of substance.
All right, thank you.
The last slide is our vacancies. We're currently 12 vacant positions. 6 positions are in the recruitment process, or maybe some of those have already been filled. And then we have 5 positions that are on hold due to the hiring freeze. That includes a number of accountants and a principal contributor position. And then the one position is really the positions that we abolished in the e-commerce area.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Edward? Thank you very much, John. Appreciate your bringing that forward.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you for coming forward and for presenting your budget. We'll continue to deliberate on that. And let's see, Human Resource Services Division, Sue Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Just very quickly, I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services. I wanted to have an opportunity to introduce Sue Wilson to you. Sue is the Acting Administrator for our Human Resources Division. Some of you know that Dan Kennedy retired at the end of December. He was here a long time, did a wonderful job. I'm trying to fill that job right now. Sue has, some of you may know from her long career in the Legislative Assembly, 18 years, I think, plus, and then about a year with DAS now. And so she's holding down the fort while I do a recruitment. So it's a real pleasure to have her step sit down and do this.
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Wilson. I'm acting administrator of the Human Resource Services Division. A whole 10 days now, so I'm going to do what I can here to work through the budget. Everybody's been great in working through this. I don't even know the acronyms well enough to probably use them, but I will certainly contribute to your cause.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Go to the American Cancer Society.
That's
and
wonderful.
Representative Johnson will stop you when you use an acronym that I don't understand.
Okay, you got it. The Human Resources Services Division is, in essence, the central human resources or personnel function within state government. And the state is generally viewed as one employer. And so our division's challenge is to help guide a consistent approach to human resource management in the state. That means we provide the framework for a variety of statewide systems that are used that allow agencies to know the parameters within which they need to operate in the human resource area. This reduces the risk of potential legal and monetary liabilities and ensures that we are operating in the best way possible for the state. I am going to be going through this rather quickly, but I certainly can respond and get more information if needed.
Sue, I'm going to recognize Representative Johnson.
A question about the replication of human service divisions within each of the agencies, then. If you all are overseeing personnel functions, it seems to me that the agencies do that again. Explain to me how, if you're the central repository of that information, why these huge human service departments separate from your activities?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we are, in essence, the policy arm. We're setting the overall policy for the state. But there is, as you know, so much day-to-day information and work that needs to be done in the human resources area that there's no way our small staff can actually provide for all the hiring, all the operations, all the personnel actions, all the follow-up that would need to be done in the smaller core of the agency. So we are, in essence, relatively small and at a much higher level in setting the policies to say, okay, agencies, when you go out and do your human resources work, follow these policies.
Thank you. That was responsive, Representative Johnson?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
The mission of our division is to support the success of state government by providing direction and services to promote a stable and qualified workforce. Many of the things that we do within the division are statutorily required and relate to overall systems that need to take place to have a personnel system within the state of Oregon. The overriding goal for the human resources field in these challenging times is to ensure that our systems provide for a stable, well-trained workforce that can meet the work demands that are placed on them. In order for that to happen, we need to have the state seen as an employer of choice so that we can retain and recruit high-quality employees. And we need also to work to have a diverse workforce that is reflective of the increasing diversity within the state. Our part in that framework, in creating that framework, such as classification, compensation, we need to make sure those systems are sound. We need to make sure that our state managers are knowledgeable in effective management practices. We need to have communication with the other agencies so they know and understand what it is they need to be doing in their human resources shops. And through this communication and the sharing of resources, we hope to be able to provide the parameters and what is needed to ensure consistencies, which again help to make sure that we have compliance with state personnel laws, federal laws, and rules and policies. You have our org chart, and I think you will see that the org chart from 2001-2003 and our 2003-2005 request, there is only one FTE difference. That is, we removed one FTE from our recruitment and career services. This was a position that had been involved in the School to Work program, which is no longer something that we manage under our particular operation. In general, and I'll go over these and give you just a little bit more specific information, our services are focused in seven areas. We have administration, classification and compensation, human resource management and consultation, labor relations, personnel systems, recruitment and career services, and training and development. Administration is the smallest section of the division. The administrator of Human Resources Services Division acts as sort of the contact point for the division, and working with the DAS director and the governor's policy staff, make sure that the issues and the policies related to human resources are communicated and managed within the state government. This office is also responsible for administration of this particular division. Classification and compensation provides an ongoing maintenance of the structures that are required by statutes that apply to state agencies. They perform the ongoing evaluations of new and revised job classes and determine appropriate compensation. They also perform market studies of how the compensation for various jobs compares with the market and play a key role in our collective bargaining to make sure that all the market information is there for the bargaining table. Human Resources Management and Consultation section develops those policies that we talked about that apply statewide, such as managing position authority, leave-related policies, other things that are going to apply to all human resource operations. They are also a resource to agency human resources staff who may seek some guidance on how do I properly apply this particular policy, what do I need to do in this situation, and again, the key here is it helps us to ensure consistent application. Since we are viewed as one employer, it's important that our rules and policies be applied consistently across state government. This staff also includes the human resource audit staff, who work directly with agencies to ensure compliance with the rules and the laws and actually conduct audits of various situations. And we also in this group have, there are a number of agencies that are actually too small to support having a human resource function of their own. They don't have their own personnel office. We do provide that function to about 11 small agencies. Our labor relations section represents the state in collective bargaining agreements. And the state now has agreements with 32 bargaining units, represents about 25,000 state employees. We also have one bargaining unit that covers 12,000 non-state employees, home care workers. The unit does not only the bargaining, but the ongoing administration of these contracts. And they're the central source of questions related to the application and the management of the contracts. Again, since they're statewide in many cases, we want to ensure consistent application of the contracts. Personnel system.
Keep going, please.
Personnel systems are the technical database systems that we use statewide to manage the vast amount of data that's associated with personnel. The centralized databases are for all past and current employee records, and these systems do interface to a certain extent with both the payroll system to make sure that information entered into the personnel database rolls up to the payroll system for accurate information. It also interfaces with budget and management to help give them the information that they need to be generating personnel services budgets for the agencies at budget time. Our recruitment section provides centralized recruitment services. They manage a statewide contract for newspaper advertising so that we can advertise in one place for many different vacancies in a variety of agencies. They also maintain a centralized information system on job applicant information and coordinate the state's presence at job fairs, campus recruitments, and other types of job situations.
Two, that's not done over an internet website somewhere?
Mr. Chair, recruitment or...
The job posting and those kinds of things?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do definitely use websites and have those available for people. Everything that we post is out on the web for use. However, we do still find that some on-site job fairs and job recruitments help to bring more applicants into the state.
Okay.
The Executive Recruitment and Diversity Unit works specifically with minority communities as a part of the state's recruitment program to try to increase the pool of minority candidates available for state positions. This position also works specifically on executive level recruitment, such as filling agency head vacancies. The Training and Development Services Unit has undergone a number of changes in the last year and offers management development courses for all levels of state managers, trying to focus on the manager's needs, such as we have some people who are completely new to state government. They have certain training needs. We have people who are completely new to management but have some training needs, and we're finding a large group of people who have professional and technical backgrounds, have been in the state system for a while, find themselves now in management that have never had to learn management skills. So we're trying to address those people too.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
I guess I've got a problem with hiring managers who don't come with the basic skill set to be managers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there certainly are some qualifications that are available for people who are coming new to the state from outside of state government. We often find that they have management, they have some management backgrounds, but they don't understand or know the state system. That's our focus for those particular people. For those who have no background as managers, a lot of times agencies are trying to develop them into managers. So we want to catch them early on and try and give them the skills that they need.
Please follow up.
That might be an area that I would like to talk to you about without taking the committee's time to do that. It just seems to me that part of the recruitment process, particularly in this economic climate, ought to be hiring people that are work ready, and that it is not the state of Oregon's job to turn people into managers. You ought to recruit for that and hire for that, and I'm just trying to figure out how much money we're spending in creating capabilities that may not otherwise be there.
Thank you. Representative Patridge is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any this agency obviously sets a lot of the, for lack of a better term, policy goals for the internal hiring process for the state of Oregon. What kind of input does the agency get from the private sector or other employers as a result of trying to help set policy goals in terms of providing agency direction as to the recruitment and hiring process?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are some situations where private.
I know you've only been there 10 days.
Yeah, I'm going to just take a quick shot, and then I will follow up and get you more. I know that there have been some situations where agencies have gone out and brought in private recruiters actually to look for or to assist with the recruitment of a particularly difficult situation or position that's difficult to fill.
I guess follow up. Just maybe as an extension. I guess each of these groups has a constituent group that each of the state agencies has a constituent group to some degree or another that they recruit for. ESSEL would have some expertise that the agency would have, as well as some shortfalls. So what I'm asking is, you know, it's hard maybe internally for people who are working with a particular agency to say, hey, these are shortfalls in the hiring that you're doing within your agency. We don't feel that you're getting people with the proper X, Y, or Z skill. I'm wondering if you guys have done any kind of, you help agencies do their own analysis as to where their particular shortfalls. Can you be brought in from another department head, whatever department it is in state government, to say, hey, listen, we're hiring all these people, but I'm not sure my HR people are really doing the recruiting or hiring the people with the skill set that I particularly need. Do you provide those? Do you provide that service? And if so, do you use anybody from the outside, kind of, is what I guess I'm asking for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I will follow up on that, but I do know that our executive recruitment person does work specifically with agencies to try and help and identify what the real.
But I guess I'm talking about, I mean, DAS is kind of the COO. That's how Gary got pegged in the paper, nice article, but I'm asking for if you bring those consulting services to the fold for state agency. Do you have the ability to come in and say your HR department is not really, not just an executive recruitment, but in, you know, an overall approach and policy and scoping as to what the expertise is needed, or do you guys have outside resources that you would bring in to do that? I'm just interested because, you know, there's a lot of not well-trained people sometimes. Getting back to Representative Johnson's question as to work ready, and the comment was made during the presentation that, well, you have people with technical skills that have no management skills, and you kind of promote them up through agencies, and I found in doing that in our companies that they don't get there a lot of the time either, you know, unless they're self-motivated. So I guess that's what I'm asking for. Can they use you as a resource? So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, I'll get back with some more information on that for you.
Thank you very much. That's an excellent
comment. As far as factors affecting the service that we do provide, the work that we do is highly affected by changes in laws and rules that govern personnel administration. Anytime there's a new law, federal or state court case decisions, all must be analyzed and communicated to the agencies on how it affects their own human resource management. Our office works very closely with the Attorney General's office to ensure consistent interpretation and application of those law changes. Our work is also highly affected by any elements that change the nature of the state's workforce. Our workforce is getting older, and today nearly 36% of the state's workforce is over the age of 50, compared to 24% 10 years ago. That number is going to continue to grow as those of us get much closer to that age. As Gary Weeks indicated in his overview, the system itself must learn to respond to some of these new issues, and we're looking a lot at areas such as succession planning as being something that we need to put some efforts into. When agency resources are reduced, also, we find that they tend to come to the centralized agency looking for assistance. So that also affects the services that we provide, and we're also affected by technology. Our systems were designed as standalone legacy systems. They don't necessarily integrate well with others. They've been patched repeatedly, and handling large volumes of information and providing meaningful management data becomes more difficult as these systems age. Interagency, intergovernmental programs, in essence, everything we do could be considered interagency programs. We're working constantly with agencies on a variety of subjects and issues. We do have a couple specific programs, the Promise Internship Program, which brings low-income interns into the state service. We have several programs working with the tribal governments, and also there's a considerable effort being done on the coordination of training between agencies so that we're not duplicating resources, and looking at management competencies. Our administrative cross controls relate largely to our communication, which we do a great deal of. To that end, we use electronic communications to reduce cost, allows our messages to be delivered to a broader audience. All of our policies, procedures are all now posted on the web. We're no longer producing paper copies of those. Everyone who needs to have the latest version goes to the web for the latest version, and we can again ensure that we're having consistent information out there since it's all available on the web. We also use a lot of listservs to communicate out to agency heads, to human resource managers and others, so that we can get that out to the broadest audience possible and again hopefully ensure compliance with the rules and policies.
Mr. Chair, I'll pause for a second again and let you all find the budget management handout. It should be very similar to the one that was available for the Controller's Division. Of course, it was the Human Resource Services Division on the front of it. Ready?
Please.
Okay. The Human Resource Services Division budget is a 12.3% increase from the 2103 legislatively approved budget through the fifth special session. You'll see that the percentage increase in the non-limited portion of their budget looks fairly substantial, and I'll talk about that in a second when we get a couple slides into the presentation. Most of the increase in real dollars is due to personal service roll-ups, and you'll see again in when we look at the pie chart that this division really is driven by personal service costs. This is a human capital sort of environment, so you'll see that in a moment. Again, turning to the next page, the division's budget is largely limited other funds, about 88%, and a small portion related to non-limited other funds. The governor's budget, again, as I mentioned, is a 12.3% increase from the 2103 legislatively approved through fifth special session level, and the budget really continues core functions. There are no enhancement packages in this budget. $11.5 million total funds. Again, you see here, as I mentioned earlier, that personal services drives the bulk of expenditures in this division, 71%, versus service and supplies costs at about 29%. Turning to the next page, talking about development of the governor's budget, we began with approximately $10.5 million in the legislatively adopted budget for the current biennium. There were actions taken through April 2002, largely a reduction here in this division, about $622,000, and those were one-time reductions related to the second special session. Base budget adjustments included, for the most part, position actions, compensation changes, and how those rolled up into the 03-05 biennium. And then we had an increase in non-limited other funds expenditure, and that offsets a reduction that you'll see in a policy package. Basically, we shifted some data processing costs from the limited category to the non-limited category. And that was as a result of how some functions internally shifted from control within the division to information resource management division. So we'll talk about that later on in more detail if you'd like. Essential packages, about $500,000 total. And again, Sue will talk about that in a moment in some more detail. The only policy package, and it's not an enhancement package, it's actually a reduction, and that's that $625,000 that you see reduced in their limited budget and rolled into their non-limited budget in the base. Assessments and fees, the assessment charge to state agency has increased from $10.6 million in the 2003 biennium to $11.1 million in the governor's 0305 proposal. Service charges have decreased from about $700,000 in the current biennium to about $400,000 in the governor's proposed budget. And again, when we get to work session, we'll need to talk about technical adjustments related to both the salary freeze and other position or compensation-related activities. And again, that is the super brief run-through.
Senator Winters is recognized.
I want to go back. I just have a question on human resources, and that is the function and the outcome of the Employee Suggestion Award Program. What has been the outcome? How much has been saved as a result of that position?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have it in here somewhere because I was looking specifically. Here we are. The information that I received on this shows that the verified 2000 in the year 2000, the savings that were generated from that program were $220,517. It's staffed by a 0.5 FTE. With a biennial cost of about $126,000. The overall verified savings since the program began in 1980 is about $18 million.
Since I was here when that was done and was one of the people who was involved, I was kind of hoping that the number down was larger, but wanted to see what the success had been over time with the position itself, because it was designed in order to allow those with inside of the agencies to begin to bring forth suggestions that would help, reduce costs and get at efficiencies.
Thank you.
I have a few more slides, Mr. Chair. Growth and reduction, I think we already talked about in terms of the organization chart. We did reduce the one limited duration position that was focused on school to work. Our program performance measures, and these are our division-wide performance measures, the measure that we want to have is an annual turnover rate for state workforces 5.5% or less. That is just for voluntary separations. It doesn't include retirements. We actually, this last year, our turnover rate went down to 4.6%. I think given the economic conditions, more people were staying put, so we didn't see our turnover going up. Our retirement, however, did go up, and in January was at 3.3%. A year ago, it was 2%, so we did see our retirement turnover going up. The second performance measure is our racial ethnic diversity in the state workforce as a percentage of the total civilian labor force. What we'd like to do is make sure that the state government as a workforce reflects the diversity within the overall state population. We currently, within the state government workforce, have a diversity level of about 11% of our workforce. Within the state as a whole, and this is not the state workforce, but all of state population, diversity level is about 17%. So we have some work to do in increasing the diversity within state government employees. And the third measure is to try to get 66% of all state managers meeting all newly established management competencies and expectations. We are working with agencies to agree on those competencies and get everyone up to those levels, given turnover the first year we put them in and the fact that we're not going to have a full biennium most likely to work on these. We did set the mark rather low to start with at 66%. Given our turnover, we think that's realistic to try and meet. We will try and upgrade that every biennium.
Representative Johnson's right.
I'm just going to renew this as an issue. I mean, 66% is barely half of all state managers meeting the baseline requirements of management competencies. I just don't think that's a very lofty standard. And it's one of the things that I think we keep hearing about from the public in terms of just even things as minimal as service over the counter. It's my experience that attitude with employees starts with the management, and to have only 66% of state managers meet the baseline requirements of management competencies, I wouldn't take a lot of pride in that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, part of the issue here is there has not been established competencies specifically that have been agreed across all state agencies, and that's one of the things that we're trying to get to, is get to what are the agreed upon competencies for state managers.
Follow up, Representative Johnson, and let me just say this. I'm wondering if you got 66% competency amongst your managers, what does that say for your work? Of course, itself. I'm concerned about that, too. Please proceed, Representative.
And I guess I'm deducing from what you're saying that there's a certain negotiated element to what constitutes these competencies. I'm looking at a chief operating officer, and my private sector business experience says these are the competencies because the COO says. And I don't know why it's so difficult to have agreement with the agencies about what will constitute baseline management competencies. That strikes me as easy as a memo and not some lengthy negotiated process.
Senator Winters, recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just want to follow up. Who sets the guides and the parameters of how what a manager, what's the scope of management, one position to 10 individuals to 12, who, where, because I kind of hear all kinds of scales out there. Some agencies have 1 to 9, some has 1 to 12. What are the parameters?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I am not aware of any specific staff-to-management ratios that are there.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
One other thing that's kind of been a niggling problem for me, and I have to go back now almost 5 years, which I will admit is a long time, but I was a manager of a division, now a freestanding agency, and I recall some of the pieces of fiction that I saw drift across my desk in terms of position descriptions, what constituted the desirable traits for a recruitment. I would hope that one of the things that you folks would do, particularly under experienced leadership that has been given, I think, a new mandate from our governor, to get some of the recruitment process standardized so that there are fundamental characteristics that would qualify a state manager for consideration, whether it's in senior services or transportation or corrections. I mean, it seems to me that these, and maybe you're doing it with these competencies, but allowing the agencies to fabricate some of the recruitments, I saw some of the greatest pieces of fiction writing I've ever seen in terms of dressing up recruitments to try to either meet a specific individual's background in VITA, or to pad up a position so that it would move from a principal exec G to I. And I hope that that's one of the things that you're looking at.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, and I think I can address that for you in one of our slides in terms of reviewing new positions and what classification they should be.
I mean, Pulitzers ought to be awarded for some of the acts of fiction that are in those recruitment.
Thank you. Senator Winters, recognize.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Because that brings up another question, because reclassification implies that, you know, somehow you reach another level of competency are required. So if the standards don't exist, how do we have this elaborate reclassification system?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I don't want to allude that there are absolutely no standards at all for management and what's going on. The classification system does clearly indicate the areas of work that are need to be done within the variety of classifications of state management. The principal exec management series does show from classification to classification what additional duties, what additional responsibilities are expected under those particular positions.
So you do have a framework with which to begin, and I would kind of share Representative Johnson, if you've got that framework, then it becomes a letter saying that thou shalt.
Okay, Sue, continue.
Essential packages. Again, the miscellaneous personal services adjustment and program adjustments. This restores the one-time administrative reductions that were taken during the 2002 second special session. What's included in that $424,000 largely came out of a rent reduction we were able to do because of some reorganization. That money was added back into our data processing, again, to try to maintain the technical systems that we have. There's small amounts of travel and office supplies that are also included in that. And the inflation and price list adjustments are based on the, again, the directions from budget and management. Our program reduction is package 90, which CORA went through shifting the $625,000 for data processing from our other funds to other funds non-limited for the maintenance of our legacy personnel systems. That's the money with which we pay our information resource management division to maintain and upkeep our systems. There was a budget note that, actually we had two budget notes to respond to. Senate Bill 5502, the Human Resource Services Division received three new positions in its 2001-2003 budget to support the legislative directives related to conducting audits. And those are personnel audits. We did conduct a number of audits during the 2001-2003 biennium. Most of them were driven by legislative concerns about position reclassifications. There were also legislative budget notes that were put into other agencies' budgets that required us to go in and do some personnel audits. And then also on issues that were identified by our human resources staff as areas of potential risk to the state. What we found in doing these audits, the classification audit and the three agency specific reviews that we were asked to perform, looked at 464 positions. We found that 80 of these positions, about 17%, were misallocated. We corrected the allocation of those positions into the proper classification. The estimated savings from that, had those positions been in the higher classification for the biennium, the total of those 80 positions is $622,000. We also reviewed, as a division, 350 additional positions that were coming through as requests for reclasses during the interim, or as requests for reclasses as part of the 03-05 budget preparation. We reviewed 350 of those. Again, about 12% we found were in the wrong classification. Making those corrections, not having those positions reclassified, saved approximately $426,000.
Would that hold true throughout state government, Sue, or is this just a random selection of 400 and 500 positions?
Yeah, we looked at about 800 total positions. I think that this is part of why the audit program is there and why we will try to expand our audits out into others. We're also continuing to review all the new reclasses that are coming up. And as much as staffing allows, I think perhaps you'll find that there is a certain percentage of misallocation.
Where were these 800, which departments, can you ask?
Well, a lot of them were across all agencies.
Across agencies,
yeah,
I see.
I think that's probably the easiest.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
Following on your line of thinking, you did 800 audits. 50% of them were wrong or resulted in
It was a lower percentage. It was 17% for the first group and 12% for the second group.
Help me with the math. You just said you looked at 800 positions. And what am I not getting here? The reclassification audit, three agency-specific reviews, included 464. Where's the 800 come from?
The combination of 464 and the 350.
Okay.
So overall, throughout the whole program, we reviewed close to 800.
So you reviewed close to 800, mm-hmm. And of those 800, 17%.
On a high end, 17% were misallocated.
Resulting in roughly $1 million in savings. I'm just headed down the same path that Representative Butler's on. If you look over the entire universe of state employees over time and look at all of those, I'm wondering how many times 17% translates into $1 million.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I don't have an answer without actually doing it. Obviously, that's a considerable staff drain to be doing specific audits on all positions.
Well, then maybe if the staff drain is too much, the level of scrutiny by which any reclass comes forward, you could save going back retroactively and trying to unring the bell by taking a much tougher look at reclasses going forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we are indeed. We have a process now in place with budget management whereby when reclass packages come into budget management, they are sent down to us for review, and we determine at that point in time if it is in the correct classification. So future of reclasses, there is a process in place for all of those to be reviewed.
Is there any concomitant discussion with agency human resource departments to try to inculcate in managers that a reclass is not a common occurrence but a very big deal? Because it seems to me that if you're talking about the amount of scrutiny that reclasses are given, you could nip that in the bud if the agencies didn't allow the discussion to occur at the agency level.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we do require that the agencies write up, that their HR shops write up a justification for the reclass before it is sent into budget and management. There's a variety, again, of potential education and training that needs to be done for agency staff on how to appropriately look at classification. It is a very technical subject area, and there is expertise within the central, but often there's not the same level of expertise in the agencies.
Let me just ask a question in that regard, and then we'll go back to Senator or Representative Johnson. The concern I guess I have is you're not reviewing all reclasses. This was just an audit of reclassifications within the agencies. The agencies pretty much generate their own reclassifications without the oversight of the Department of Administrative Service. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct, Mr. Chair, any longer. When an agency does a reclass, they must send their reclass package to budget and management, and we then do review all of those reclasses. So from this point forward, all those reclass packages will be reviewed for appropriate classification.
But the audit itself that was performed was of those that already had come through as reclasses, and what you were doing was you were in effect going back and auditing that which had already gotten out of the barn, in effect.
That's correct.
And did that then generate a modification? That would be about 100 of those 814 positions. Did that generate a reclass on those?
Mr. Chair, there's sort of been a combination of things. We were directed to look at certain agencies. We did go in and look at those specific agencies, and in some cases there were changes to those existing classifications in those agencies. in addition to that, we did look at reclass packages coming through. So we did make some changes in existing programs, and that would have been reflected then in the agency budgets.
Okay. But the savings of something in excess of $1 million in the two sets of reclassification examinations, those were for all positions which had already been reclassed, or that was work in progress?
Mr. Chair, it was a combination.
All right, good. All right. Representative Johnson, Representative Patrick, recognized?
So did this result in the changes in any policies either within the agencies themselves or with DAS HR division as to how those are reviewed, how to proceed? I guess that's the next question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, we did work, it did result in a more formalized process between Human Resources Services and Budget and Management in how those packages would be reviewed. Also, in the past, there were some agencies who were considered certified agencies who, in essence, could do their own review. We no longer allow agencies to do their own review of those reclass packages.
But can we maybe get a list of those items that I'd like to know internally what policies were changed on a specific basis as to better manage the process as we go forward?
Ms. Wilson will give us that.
Gary's got it.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just
make sure
we can get some context to this. The audits came, were supposed to have been developed at the time the agencies got the authority to do their own reclasses. Reclasses used to come to all of you through the emergency board system when the emergency board was in place, or Ways and Means at the time. And then the agencies were given the authority to do the reclasses. And at the time that authority was passed to the agencies, there was supposed to have been an audit process that was going to be conducted to assure that there was high quality reclasses.
Right.
And the fact is, there really wasn't an audit process. I mean, I've lived through these times, and I was pretty sure when I was doing reclasses that there wasn't going to be any audit because, one, the division wasn't ever funded to provide enough audit capacity to do it, and it wasn't a priority without casting aspersions on anyone historically. And so it's only pretty recently, and at the direction of the legislature, because my memory is you helped pick out some of the agencies mm-hmm. that you wanted to be audited, that the audit function that Sue was telling you about actually came into play, and without that coming into play, you don't have any sort of impact on agency as who know that their decisions are going to be audited. And I think what we're trying to do is create the environment that says, one, we're going to help you make good decisions about your classifications, and two, there are going to be some serious follow-up audits to find out, you know, who's doing this well.
Senator Devlin had a question. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to an earlier question, I think the question was from Representative Johnson about there being no review of reclassifications at your level. You said that's no longer the case. That would imply that it was the case up to some certain time. When did that start, actually?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, exactly as Gary Weeks indicated, last session the legislature gave to Human Resources Services Division the staff to be able to conduct audits. It was something that had not been done, it had not been funded, and it had not been identified as a high priority. So really, although there had been some, I think, audits in the past, it was not set into a process. If something came through to budget management that really raised flags, they might have it reviewed. But it's really just since last session, so this biennium, that we have formalized the audit process.
Follow-up, Senator Dillon.
Related to that, I was looking through your budget narrative, and it's about the evaluation of the classification plan. And it appears that you haven't had a major review of the state classifications since the mid-1980s, which would probably relate to all the pay equity studies. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, that's correct. About 68% of our classifications, as far as the classification content themselves, have not been reviewed since the mid to late 80s.
Thank you.
Representative Patrick, you recognize?
I guess going back to Senator Devlin's first question, that was my point, was I want to know, as a result, I mean, they shouldn't have to be audited in order to do it right, I guess, is why the legislature gave them the authority to do it internally themselves. Now that we've gave you the staff and you discovered problems, I'm asking for what are the driving factors. If you're asking to place some definition around what I asked for, was now that you've discovered these items, what internal policies and procedures do you have in place in order to provide a check so that you don't get 17%? I mean, and correct if I'm wrong, Representative Butler, but these accounting agencies go out and do lots of audits, but they don't, you know, but hopefully that's what drives them, the changes in policies and procedures, and you don't have that problem the next time. And I'm asking for what has DAS done for their policies and procedures as well as the agencies you've audited to prevent these problems in the future.
Representative Johnson and Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm taking Representative Patridge's question to a simpleton's level. At this point, then, there are no longer any certified agencies that are doing any reclasses, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, all reclasses should be coming through for review.
Should or are?
Well, are as far as we know. I mean, yes, they are, because they have to come to budget management. We have the process in place. Budget management is sending them to us.
Just for grins, give me a flavor of what agencies were certified, three of them.
I'm not sure that, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I can tell you, but I can find out.
EHS, I know that. Mr. Chairman, Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Johnson. DHS is certified, Department of Transportation is certified, mm-hmm. and I believe DCBS is certified.
And Corrections
is certified.
The interesting point of that is that's where the lion's share of the employees are, and it seems to me that if you're going to have an audit process with any integrity, that at Corrections, DHS, and ODOT, that ought to end yesterday, and that you guys should see every single one of those.
Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, you know, I raised this issue twice at EBOR. Of the issue of reclassifications without oversight, because this body, when I learned that this body, the legislative body, had turned this over to the Department of Administrative Services, because it used to be a function of the legislature. And whenever an agency wanted to do reclassifications, particularly upward reclassifications, they came to the legislature for approval. And it did pose some interesting concerns and issues during the budget crisis when we were having reductions and agencies were coming in requesting reclassifications upward. And I'm happy to hear that you're doing the audits. I, too, would like to see clearly what the audit direction says to the agencies because they should not, you know, have carte blanche authority to be increasing, to reclassify positions. That then leads us back to some of the prior discussions that Representative Johnson raised when we were talking about so-called standards and how do you determine whether or not that reclassification is really valid or not. I asked the question for managers. It used to be you could change responsibilities and add the caveat and duties as assigned without having to increase the compensation. So I'm one who would very much, huh? That's what we, you know?
So, Representative Johnson, coming back to your question, when we talk about agencies that are certified, those are certified agencies that are having all of the class reclassing done and have had all the reclassing examined or have not?
Mr. Chair, currently the process is now set up with budget management that we will review all of the reclassifications that come through, including from those agencies who have been previously designated as certified.
Mr. Chair, it would be interesting to have some information as to how, with them having that kind of authority over the years, what has been their increase on the management side vis-a-vis what's happening out in the line side. You know, for my agency that I'm responsible for, I get very concerned that we're not getting top-heavy and that, you know, dollars are being spent out in program versus vis-a-vis dollars are spent at the central level. So it would be interesting for me to have some trend lines of what has happened with reclassifications over time.
Is that information available, Sue? you know.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure, but I can sure check.
Historical information over over that ratio of management to line file employees, if we could get that. Further questions before you proceed? Go ahead, please. I think you're on budget note 5091.
Mr. Chairman, before Sue, can I just add two, I think, important points of clarification? I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Chairman, here, but I think it's important to get the record clear that we don't do the Department of Higher Education or Oregon University System and stuff. I should make sure you understand that there are roughly 25% of our workforce is in that system. They do all their own classification. I don't know to what extent they have an audit function, but they're outside of what DAS has the authority. And the second thing I think is important for you to understand is that all these reclasses are supposed to be budget neutral. In other words, if I want an upward reclassification, I have to downward reclassification, or I have to abolish a position to create the expenditures necessary to do the classification upward. That was all part of the deal years ago, and I was one of your legislative fiscal analysts years ago when this deal was made, and we were struggling when these reclasses came to you, either through Ways and Means or the Emergency Board. We didn't have any idea whether they were good classifications or not either. That was part of the challenge we were facing, because we were having to say, yeah, this looks fine, you know, and eventually it was agreed, we'll give this back to the agencies with a good, strong audit function and real clear instruction and mandatory, no-cost basis for any reclassification. That was all part of the historical agreement, and the audit never actually took place. And you can leave a position vacant in order to get the savings and stuff, or you can abolish things. And I know that there's a sense in the building that from time to time some agencies have gotten positions from the legislature and then used those positions to upwardly reclassify other positions and stuff. There is that sense there, and the extent to which that's true is... I know this comes as a surprise to some of you.
Guilty as charged. I've done it.
So, and having done it also, I know how it works, but that the way the system was, and we were the police ourselves, and the reality is, because we didn't have the audit function, there was no real strong expectation from the agency heads that they were going to be audited. And I think what Sue is saying is we're trying to change that by having every position come into BAM first, and then down to us for review of the reclass, and then also to maintain a real strong audit function, particularly for the four agencies that have their own authority to do this reclassification. So I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Chairman. But
I guess the concern I've got is if it is supposed to be expense neutral by the time it's all done, when you're working on a particular upward reclass, then what you're doing is that you're cutting off some of the line items down below. And that's why that ratio of management to labor would be important. And then let's see, Representative Johnson and Representative Patrick.
I just wanted, at the point of beating this to death, you said have their own certification. That should be had, right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, there still are those four agencies who have the authority to run their own classification system.
Without BAM oversight.
Well, we still have the authority, Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, we still have the authority to go in and audit and would audit those agencies who have their own authority. Just the fact that they get certified does not mean that they're not going to be subject to some kind of review.
They still have the authority to do their own reclassification without coming through BAM? Or is that's not what you're saying, is it? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, no. Okay. I'm sorry if I mistaken.
Okay.
That.
Representative Patrick.
When they do the reclass, and now that it's going to BAM, do you eliminate those other positions that they're using to fill those, or do those get rolled up every time?
I'll try and speak to this, although I am not the expert in it. But just to use an example, if I have an agency who has what we call a permanent financing action, they return in their reclass requests to our SABRES division. It's a statewide audit and budget reporting system that the PICS people, that's the personnel system. Their permanent financing plan would show the increase, the request for an increase would also show the specific position that they were either abolishing or reclassing downward or eliminating a portion of their full-time equivalent, something to get to the dollars that are necessary for the upward action on the other side. That request would come from that section where it gets logged in. Everything is processed to make sure that the dollars work on each side. Then that position is, or that request is given to the budget management analyst, who then shares that information with the audit division. As Sue has talked about, they go through their process, they send it back upstairs to us with recommendations that say, yes, this meets criteria, which a good chunk of the time it actually does meet the criteria. If it does, we take a look at it again, make sure that we don't have any other issues with it, and it goes back to the SABRE section. And then that position that had been eliminated is no longer there when we do the PICS freeze, for example, for the next time, which sets up the roll-up for any future biennium. Now, depending on when the action occurs, there are obviously some manual things that may have to be done, but the intention is if it happens by a certain date, it is gone. So those positions are eliminated. You can't continue to just roll forward and, you know, sort of have the best of both worlds, so to speak.
Okay. Further questions then for Sue relative to that before we move on to House Bill 5091? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Another budget note. DAS implemented a hiring freeze on June 10, 2002 to restrict hiring to only those positions that are essential to state government's business and affect the health, welfare, and safety of the public. Human Resource Services Division has made three reports to the emergency board on the status of those freezes. These are the numbers that were given. It shows basically that September 1, 2002, we had 3,706 vacancies in the state. As of January 1, 2003, we had 4,196, most of which were there because of the freeze. I know that within legislative fiscal that there are some other presentations. I believe Larry Nisswender was making a presentation to the full Ways and Means regarding vacancies and the hiring freeze also. But we'd be happy to follow up with any further information if you need on this topic.
Any questions relative to those amounts and numbers? Okay, please.
Within the Human Resource Services Division, we have 52.42 FTE. The number of vacancies that we have are 12. We have three positions that are in the recruitment process currently. We have seven positions that are frozen. Six of those frozen positions are unfunded board member positions. They don't actually show up in our budget. They just show up in the vacancy run. We also have two positions that will be abolished, an office specialist and a human resource analyst.
How is it that unfunded board member positions are frozen?
What are those?
What specific board is
it? It is the Public Officials Compensation Commission.
They show up as positions.
What does it do?
The Public Officials Compensation Commission, right at the moment, I don't believe it's functioning. but in the past, it has been used to review the various compensation levels of public officials.
Okay, Representative Johnson.
How come as unfunded positions, they're considered positions? Why are they even carried?
Really good question. So far, we haven't found any really good answers to that one. Like I say, they do not show up in our personnel runs for the budget. They just show up in the vacancies. So they are in there. They would be there simply for, the $30 or whatever.
Yeah, but then how come there's not a proliferation of these? When you look at all the commissions that there are, that I'm sure at any given time statewide, there are vacancies on those ostensibly volunteer boards. that maybe get a little bit of mileage. It seems like a kind of curious way to carry what are volunteer positions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I do believe for the purposes of being able to give the people compensation for their travel, they will show up across state government and the variety of boards and commissions that are out there. These are not appointed at this point in time.
Senator Devlin is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For all those which are just paid some type of per diem, many of them, we have to still cover them for workers' comp, don't we, while they're in there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we do have some provisions around volunteers and workers' compensation. I don't know the specifics of how they are covered.
So the 12 vacancies within the 52, and included in that is the 6 of the unfunded positions, which are presently not really functioning as a compensation commission. So you effectively, with 6 positions down, you're 10% down. 3% or 3 of those are presently in recruitment.
Is the 6 in the 52?
Mr. Chair, the 52.42 does not include those 6 positions.
Does not include, okay. That's FTE, which would be full-time employees equivalent.
That's correct.
And these are not employees, and there is no equivalency then. It'd be zero FTE with each of those. Representative Patridge is recognized.
Well, that's my next. How many FTEs are you down as opposed to how many vacancies do you in position? It's hard to, if we're comparing apples and oranges. How many FTE are you down?
1, 2, 3. Is it 6?
6. So those are all full-time positions.
Okay. Further questions? And that brings us to the end of your presentation. We've got 33 minutes to go ahead with the BAM, Budget and Management Division. Theresa McHugh, thank you. So we appreciate it.
You're
you didn't really use that many acronyms. It was more Cora.
I'll bring my contribution tomorrow.
Thank you very much.
Budget management should probably just bring a general one for the whole.
Thank you. No, it was my weakness. Good morning. For the record, I'm Teresa McHugh with the Budget and Management Division. I imagine at some point we'll actually have some of the same discussions on some of the pieces that we were already talking about here, but we'll wait to get to those. Make sure I'm doing this right. Just hit the enter button. Is it just enter? Okay, great. In terms of budget management, we're one of the divisions you actually see here in lots of different capacities. But today, the general things that we really focus on are providing information, and that's our primary job, is to provide accurate statewide budget and management information. The management information we intend to provide is still around the budget area, for example, allotment information, personnel by budgeted FTE, for example, those kinds of things. We do prepare the governor's recommended budget. What that budget does is a couple of things. One is it's intended to obviously convey the governor's policy agenda in terms of where he would put the prioritized dollars for the next biennium. But it's also the first place where we do a very detailed, audited, down to the line item, hook up to the accounting system, and make sure everybody in the state uses the same data. So that inflation factors are used correctly, we are catching things and making sure that the right positions are in there, all those things, so that the budget you're dealing with, you know, is clean at that detailed level, and that when you're making adjustments, you can make them at a higher level versus at that detailed level. The next time that happens is after we have a legislatively adopted budget, and we go in and do the same thing at that point to make sure at that detailed level we reconcile back to the legislative intent. During the interim, we do monitor agency and spending activities to ensure compliance with legislative direction and gubernatorial direction. Some of those things are addressed administratively where there's the authority, and then often you will see us at the emergency board where we bring agencies forward to say, you have this authority, you need to come back to the emergency board to get legislative direction. And then we also have a role in assisting in the coordination of budget for major capital construction projects. Our capital investment section works closely with the Treasury on everything from lottery bonds to issuance of certificates of participation, now to the new TANs, or Tax Anticipation Note Authority, involved, for example, the OHSU Opportunity Grant, all of those kinds of things. Our mission, again, goes back to that first thing, to give state leaders and the public objective and accurate information for the wise use of state resources. The statutory authority, primarily found in 291, that section you'll see page after page, a lot of it directing what has to be included in the governor's recommended budget. Some of those things in terms of why is that, there are all those sections in the back with all that detail often are pieces that are required by law and there. But we do have pieces, again, around capital, performance budgeting, and working with the Progress Board that are in 270, 286, and a lot of other statutes. What are our goals as we think about the next biennium? Some of you are familiar with and maybe have heard about the implementation of the first phase of ORBITS. We did have that system come up and was used for preparation of the governor's recommended budget that was presented and will be used by the Legislative Fiscal Office and you as you come to your legislatively adopted budget. This really was the replacement portion, if you will, and we're in the process now of the next phase of that. The next phase, bringing in some of the things that folks had identified as really critical to the budgeting process to get the right kind of data. While we, for example, one of the big pieces there, we started the linkage process to the accounting system so that we do have integrated systems. Some of that is built into this first phase, but that will be expanded into the next phase. Increasing access to central budget and program information. We have done a lot to put more things on the internet. This interim certainly gave us more opportunity to have new information to put out there, but we have used that as a method of getting information out to more folks. And again, the new system certainly has a capacity for reporting for a lot of different reports that were never available in the past. And then the last one is we are really trying to continue to increase training and education. And this talks about for agencies, but even broader than that, on budget issues, processes, development, and just the management of the budget process. So we have spent a lot more time working with everyone from Portland State to now we're going to try and do something even more in-house to get more budget training out there on how the state process works and how it fits into public budgeting overall, as well as a lot more going out to everyone from counties to the private nonprofits we partner with to the school districts and talking about how we work on the state budget and how it integrates with theirs. For example, the Revenue Forecast Committee for K-12 for school budgeting, a lot of the discussion there is around the processes and how they integrate so that as we get data from schools, we can get it in a useful form and likewise that they understand how the process works and what the mechanisms are on the state side. So we've done a lot more in that area and would like to continue moving even further in that area. Our sections, we're fairly a small division, we'll get to the numbers, but the primary unit is the budget and policy section, and these are the budget analysts, Cora and other folks assigned to agencies, very similar to the Legislative Fiscal Office in terms of how that organization is designed. The capital investment section, again, a couple of positions, and really do the overseeing of the statewide capital budget and then working very closely with Treasury on our bonded debt programs. And then we have SABRES, as Cora mentioned, the statewide audit and budget reporting section. And these are the folks. Oregon uses one budget system, so the legislature, the judicial branch, all of us use the same system. The governor can't necessarily give direction on use of that system to the legislative and judicial branches, but they use that same system for putting their information in so that you can actually run reports and see that. In terms of making recommendations, that's a different thing, but in terms of being able to use it and then compare that data, we all use the same system. And this is the group that audits that to make sure it is all, in fact, accurate and carries out the laws, such as the reclass law that says we will have permanent financing and make sure that, indeed, according to what's been legislatively approved, that that's in place.
Teresa, when you say you can actually run reports, you're really meaning those folks that have access to it within the building. Is that right?
At this point, that is correct. And again, although Dallas might be able to talk about the increased
capacity that legislative fiscal is going to have this session than what they've had in the past to do some online work and be able to generate some reports. But first phase is somewhat limited. As we go forward, I think that's a discussion we want to have with you is how many, what kind, where would they be generated, all of those kinds of good things. So, again, to make sure, one of the things we'll be working on is making sure that as we do that, that we still have the core data is clean, is audited, and can't be tampered with, so that even though there's other reports out there, that we have a core set that we can always come back to and make sure we have the audited versions.
Okay.
Orbits is the last section, and this is our section of limited duration positions, and this is the group that has been developing and implementing now the new system. So these are LDs. You will again see them in the process. We kick them out every biennium, and we're asking for them back for that second phase. But they have implemented on time and on budget. In fact, I think a little under budget, the first phase of the system. The next charts just get into what the org chart looks like, and you'll fundamentally see no difference between 01, 03, except for one less LD position in that orbit section. As we go forward in the next biennium and moving on to the next phase, we need one less position there. If you go back in time, you would have seen about this same number overall existing in 91, 93, but without orbits. So over time, there has been a shrinking during the 90s of the number of staff. That was a combination of positions there. At the very beginning, we had positions that were management analysts, a couple of those. Those management analysts were, in a sense, essentially fee-for-service. So agencies had to ask for it and were not what you might think of as true management analysts in terms of being able to go out and get that work done. And as agencies quit asking for it or it was not the kind of work that was seen as valuable, those phased out, as well as a couple of analyst positions and a couple of manager positions along the way. But we can get into more detail there if you'd like. But again, basically budget management has stayed stable over time with a cut during that period of time in the 90s, and now the last couple of biennium staying flat at about this number.
St. Patrick recognized.
So, for instance, does anywhere in DAS have any management analysts in it? I mean, I kind of asked that. You weren't here, I think, when I asked the question on the HR piece of it. I'm just wondering if, you know, if DAS is supposed to go out and be the COO, does it have the capabilities and resources to be able to do management evaluation?
See, I think it gets into the definition. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge. We'll get into the definition of management analysts. In terms of pure management analysts, as you think about in more of a consulting way of being able to look at an organization and overall capacity and do their management systems make place, budget and management doesn't have those people, and nor do I think DAS as a whole really has someone that has that kind of breadth. In terms of doing management work, DAS, budget and management, often takes the lead from a budget and policy perspective because we tend to be more of the generalists to put groups and teams together of folks around issues to be able to go out and do some of those things. But within budget and management, the management capacity that exists is primarily around budget issues as they come up, and then working with agencies as needed, but not in that more general capacity.
Thank you.
Service delivery. What do we focus on? Well, we're big on two things. One is making sure that we have legal compliance to the budgets. And that's kind of our number one thing, is making sure that we stand in legal compliance and that we provide direction to the agencies, that they understand what it was that the governor and the legislature were directing them to do. So communication has been a big key for us with agencies, especially during this interim, to make sure that they are understanding the messages, and then the follow-up is making sure that they follow them. Assisting policymakers. Again, we're probably one of the groups that spends almost as much time working with the legislative body as we do with the governor's office in terms of working on what policy and financial analysis is there and helping in that process. Again, the issuance and tracking of COPs and lottery bonds. We do manage the statewide budget systems. So that's the allotment system, the position inventory control position, the overall budget system. And we provide a lot of general information to the public and state agencies on state resource allocation. For performance measures, there's really, and we'll see more of it later, but we really do rely on surveys, customer feedback, and then budget data both internally as well as how we compare to other states, to evaluate our service to the executive and legislative branches. When we do customer service surveys, for us, while certainly agencies are a customer for us, we look primarily to the governor and to the legislature about whether or not we have met our mission, because that's our primary goal, is to make sure that we have both given you the information you need as well as taken the direction back to agencies and ensured compliance. Sometimes, rarely, but sometimes agencies don't necessarily view that as a positive role at times. But we also really have focused on understanding that a lot of times the real issue there is not an agency not liking the message, but not understanding the message. So we've really tried to focus on a lot stronger communication with agencies to ensure that they understand the direction so that they have every opportunity to be in compliance. Factors affecting our services, well, certainly the quality and quantity of staff always is a key for everyone. We've had less turnover, which is certainly helpful to us, and I think to all of you here, as you have analysts who have been able to be with agencies and issues for a period of time and have a little history there. Tools and data available for analysis, and again, that's one of the keys that has been, I think, for the legislature as well, the move toward ORBITS and having more information, the ability to do more detailed analysis. Number and complexity of state budgets and policy issues. Certainly this interim, there were a whole lot of things I think were on deck to have more management analysis from a budgetary capacity that due to special sessions got lost along the way. But so we tend to react to that. We don't tend to go and expand staff even on a limited basis for those kinds of things, so that number often makes a big difference. Degree of executive and legislative guidance. And that's why you will often see us coming back and saying, we want to make sure we understand. Because in the past, I think that's a place where we have not done as good a service as we could of making sure we understand the intent as we go out to agencies and do that. So again, the more that we see the coordination and good communication between the legislative and executive branch, right at, from leadership on down, that certainly helps us in doing our job. The functionality and quality of related statewide systems and staff. Again, as we go forward, I think the move toward more integration of data to be able to answer questions. For example, a question that we're going to meet on later to make sure we can get some better answers than we have today for the legislature is around people, state employees. We count them and have control from a budgeted position and FTE count. That's not the same as knowing how many layoffs, how many people are impacted, et cetera. So as we go forward, I think you'll see, for example, the personnel and position database system in Human Resource Services Division being on the agenda down the road to say we really need to integrate those in so that we can provide that kind of information. Some of that also gets into how we, especially in the general fund area, when 44% of the budget projected at least goes to K-12, is how we start working with the database and K-12 to be able to get you information about the places that budget and management doesn't have direct authority. And then certainly the economy and its effect on statewide resources, just again in the sense of it does take all of our focus away and working on that. I often say to people that say, we're spending way too much time with you, and I don't take it personally, maybe I should, but I don't, but that really the issue is right now, because we're constantly playing catch-up, you spend time with the budget folks. If you get the place in the budget, whether it's through permanent reductions, permanent resources that are there, however that balance is met, then you'll spend less time with us and more time on with policy folks. Who do we work with? We work with, it feels like some days, just about everyone, but we do work with multiple jurisdictions. We work with the federal government. We stay very close to the Federal Funds Information System, which is FFIS, and we're constantly watching what's going on there, and we do stay in contact with the federal government. Not as much as a larger state, so we also tend to follow our relationship with the federal government through the actions of what is California or Texas or New York doing, and if we're consistent with them in their relationship, we have a much better chance of being successful down the road in terms of if problems occur. Obviously, state agencies, local governments, private nonprofits and businesses, and within local governments, I would include K-12 and community colleges. We really, especially given the nature of the state budget, on the general fund and lottery fund side, where 70% of it goes out in the form of a special payment, it is very important that we maintain those connections and know how we can represent what's going on. We don't do you any good if we come back and say, here's what they got last time, we can't tell you what they did with it or what they will do with it. So we really try and do that. And then,
just
of course,
in that regard, I've got a question. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No problem.
I've got a question relative to to the federal government that the requirements for maintenance of efforts with regard to the DHS issues. The concern that I've got is that local governments contribute a great deal of general funds in there, and I noticed in Kansas recently they did an analysis of how much local governments are contributing, came up with about an offsetting match from the FFIS that was necessary in order to meet that of an additional approximately $400 million.
Right.
Are you reviewing the local government's contributions and the nonprofit private contributions into local governments, into these local maintenance of efforts, to see that we get the matching offset funds?
Mr. Chair, I believe Human Services is working on that specifically, I think at the direction of one of your members here as well. But I do know as well that George Naughton from our staff, who is the Human Services Analyst, as well as John Britton, are watching all of those things very closely, whether it be the maintenance of effort or around the MUPL dollars, and watching what some other states are doing, as well as looking at creative ways to get more information in there.
I would say it would certainly be an absolute shame if, to keep our nursing homes open statewide, requiring about $11 million of state funds, if we were walking past $400 million of federal funds that should be contributed back into the system, which may be fungible in that regard. So I think that's an important thing. I commend Senator Winters for continuing to follow up on that. Senator Winters?
Chair Butler, not only are we looking, in fact, the county is also preparing information for us, and you have the county and as well as some of the private nonprofits are looking at it from the standpoint of what's happening in darks, and it's not just the obvious, but we're really combing to find whether or not we are maximizing all of the dollars.
Excellent. Thank you. Representative Patrick.
Thank you, Chair. And that raises a question for me. Tracy, do you have can you give us an idea of the capacity on your staff to deal with and monitor the federal agency regs and things that Representative Butler talks about? I mean, to capture some of those things, I know I look at your staffing chart and everything else, but can we talk a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, we certainly try and watch as closely as we can. We are somewhat limited. We have two analysts that deal with human resources, as you know, a huge area, especially during this period of time. We do have a position, the deputy director of the division, one of his primary duties is to focus on, first of all, ensuring that statewide we meet all of the requirements of the law around appropriation growth limit, cash flow, all of those kinds of things. But he also spends a good deal of his time trying to stay connected to that broader picture of what's going on nationally, how are we connected with the federal government. I think in terms of some of those pieces, though, frankly, given, I think if you look nationally, at least at one point, I haven't looked recently, but at one point, Oregon was on the lower end of budget, central budget staff for both budget and management and the legislative fiscal staff. So we work closely together so that we make sure we're not duplicating efforts where at all possible. But we do rely heavily on agencies. Human Services, we know, spends a lot of their time, and they've gotten the message, again, part of that's the direction, to say we want you to be as aggressive as you can in following these things to make sure you're getting all of them. But I couldn't say that I know some budget and management type offices actually have a position that's devoted full time to watching the federal government and the rules and regs and making sure you're in that. We don't have that.
I guess the concern again that I would have there is that if within the agencies they're monitoring that and then they're applying for grants, ultimately the application of those grants locally and within the agency is going to depend upon the agency auditors and the local auditors, the local government auditors, and I'm going to assume that in that process there's got to be a heavy reliance upon the audit and the audit opinions that come back and say, and specifically I need to know that this is happening, Teresa, that you are examining the auditor's opinion that they are complying, that local governments and state agencies are in fact complying with the federal requirements for those grants. I assume that's part of the position?
Mr. Chair, analysts do see that information. A lot of that work is done also by the State Controller's Division,
right,
as they go through and do their work to ensure that that has occurred.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Patrick?
I guess when we talk about revenue and we talk about the revenue, you know, when we talk about the revenue department and those things, we always get hit with, you know, well, if you'll hire more auditors, we'll get
you'll
so
save
much
more
money.
I
mean, has DAS really explored whether we're letting opportunities fly off the table as a result, or fall off the table as a result of our ability really not to be innovative, think outside the box, or follow those trends, whether it be a minor tweak in formulas or those kinds of things? I'm just wondering, you know, is there lost opportunity, especially as we face a budget crisis like we do, that we're cutting off our nose to spite our face in terms of our ability to monitor, watch, and think creatively? And maybe Gary wants to address it. He's playing with his pen. He might want
to. He'd like to.
I think he might want to. But
we'll let him
that's
think
what
for
I,
a second as he comes
I guess
up.
That's a concern of me with all the federal money that's available.
Right.
Whether we're maximizing our ability to gain in those things, not only in UHS, but other.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
You know, sometimes we send, as policymakers, mixed signals.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just, because I used to be on that side. And, you know, of whether or not we want to really take advantage of all the federal dollars. And that's one piece of it, because I've gone through this building when it was, you know, we didn't want to do that. Now we're in a crunch, and we're saying, yes, we want to do it. So I think, you know, we've got to be clear to the, in all fairness, the agencies and policy that we want to aggressively to go after those. And having said that, with recognizing we don't want it done in such a way that we will end up later with having some problems with the federal government. So it's there's some issues that's entwined in this that I know I'm sensitive to, and I'm sure that Gary and Teresa are sensitive to when you're talking about the federal, we call it fungible, I used to call it funny money. but, you know, being very sensitive to that. So I think our signals have to be pretty clear, too. And
our problem is our signals change every 2 years. So it is a little difficult, but I, just to address that question, I just wondered if we had to.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Patridge, I think that the short answer is we are doing our best to look at all these options. But people come forward to us, to Teresa, I know, and to me regularly saying, well, here's a place you could be matching. That you should be looking at, and we look to that. And Teresa's already mentioned to you earlier the Medicaid Upper Limit Program, which
right.
We all know is MUPL. The feds, we've taken advantage of that. They're now closing it down, and so what you see is a reducing of MUPL monies. I think I'm correct on this in this budget, and which will eventually, you know, they've closed out that. Well, now there's another plan that'll come before you. It's funded by the nursing home industry that has to do with sort of it's a provider mm-hmm. assessment, a provider tax that enables you to draw down that. We're going to look at that, and we'll look at it with you because that may be a source. But these are things, as Senator Winters points out, that, you know, as you draw that down, you come to rely on it, then when the federal government starts to close the loophole as MUPL, as they're doing in MUPL, then we're left having to say, okay, now how do we finance these things that we used to draw down Medicaid match? So the short answer is we are looking at every idea somebody has right now to maximize our federal resources. We've had Maximus, which some of you may know. Maximus is a national company that works on contract, and they basically keep a percentage of what they find. Even right after the election, I was visiting with some of their staff because they're interested in coming in to Oregon. They'll do a 3-day high-level review, give you an estimate of what they think they can bring in that you're not already bringing in, and you can make a decision. That costs you nothing. And
right.
We may actually have them do that as we settle in here to the biennium and stuff. So, and Therese can probably give you even more examples of where we're trying to maximize.
I guess the concern I'd have, though, Director Weeks, is that, you know, these are all going to require general funds, a contribution of general funds,
correct.
By and
that's
large,
correct.
and those are near and dear to our hearts right now, every dollar that we can extract. That's why the question and I appreciate Senator Winters going that direction and looking for those resources at the local level and at the private foundations that are supporting us within Oregon, because if we can use that as our local match, and I don't know that, probably in some instances the federal government may have some provisions against that, but I'm sure that we would figure out, we'd all roll up our sleeves and put on our green visors and say, let's figure out a way to make those general funds from the state if that's what they've got to be. And we'd figure that out. So I appreciate
and
that.
And, Mr. Chair, we are looking at those. We're also, we have the list, all the federal grants come, we get kind of a copy of everything that's out there, and we're watching those to say, are agencies accessing? If not, why aren't they? We also do another service, though, on grants that I think is almost just as important, and that's that we also look at them when people come forward and say, don't worry, it's a grant, it's all federal money, mm-hmm. and we can take it, and no problem, but that then rests on your shoulders 2 years later when we have now an established program in a constituency that's receiving services, and we're, in some cases, just partway into it, and the money disappears, and you're there to backfill. So we try to look at it from all those capacities. I wish... Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, in response to your question, that I could figure out a way or find a state that's done this that could be like the Department of Revenue, and I could say for, you know, two more systems or this kind of work, we can guarantee you finding those things. There's nothing that's out there. Are there lost opportunities? I think staffs are stretched, especially during this kind of an interim, but I can't tell you that if you added a couple more staff, that's the key. I do think one of the keys right now is working with you on what kind of data statewide that we can get and that really provides you better information, and that to me is one of the keys as we go forward. Okay, administrative cost controls, I think we talked about some of those, but again, we put a lot of things on the internet and aren't printing as much. We have other printing options through our new system. We used to have to go to the print plant and pick up these volumes. I always said if anyone ever came during budget season and saw how many trees we killed, I know we'd be in trouble. But so we have some more options there. We have had some vacancy savings, and we'll talk a little bit more about vacancies later. Travel costs have been reduced. We don't do a lot of travel, really, in budget and management anyway, but we do more. In a normal interim, we would do more in-state, where analysts would actually be out in the field trying to get a better handle on what does it take to operate a prison in Eastern Oregon if you're going to have one there. This interim, obviously, we did less of that for a lot of reasons. Also, nationally, the organization of state budget officers, believe it or not, there is an organization, probably one for everything, but budget officers actually worked together to, while they still were holding their conferences, and where you get a lot of this great information on the federal government, et cetera, they did a lot of it by phone and by internet so that those of us who said, you know, really, given our situation, we aren't going to be traveling, could still participate. And we're hoping they continue that for a period of time. And then, again, we went to some more automated auditing tools and less paper and for Orbitz. In terms of the proposed budget, again, we're really budget management analysis. We're a fairly small division, but we continue all permanent positions at the level approved by the O1 Assembly. And again, over 10 years, permanent staff have decreased by about the same number that the LDs are that we have. If you look at the detail for Orbitz, those, again, are all limited duration positions and professional services being requested for the next biennium. We did have a contract with Legacy Solutions, some of you may remember, was the vendor. That system is in place. We have finished out that contract, in fact, under what was estimated, and now the state staff have the base system that we will then work with you and legislative, fiscal, and the agencies to monitor and change for the future. The positions, again, the way we do this, we phase them out, and then we have a package in to talk about them. We will want to sit down after we get to this phase 2B, which is kind of the, really was the next core that the legislature was looking for in terms of data. We'll want to sit down and say, what's the long term? Because the system actually has a lot of capacity that at this point is not scheduled to be used, and we'll want to sit down and evaluate with you whether there is an ongoing process that you want to have for being able to adapt the system to current needs. And in addition, we will start also working with HRSD about the eventual, hopefully, a merger with a position system as well. Our performance measures, again, we talked about the satisfaction survey. The other one is there is a, believe it or not, again, a national ranking for budget process quality. And we set at 80%, and actually we've even set that as our goal for a couple of reasons, because there's a couple of things in the detailed ratings that we aren't sure from a policy perspective the state would want to change. For example, we are 5 points short because the governor doesn't have more authority to change budgets during an interim. So that may not be one that the legislature would want us to achieve that perfect 100%. Another place, though, where we do suffer is Oregon gets taken down for not having a stabilization fund. So, again, some of those are policy decisions we would want to face and deal with. In terms of understandable budget information and having accurate information, we receive perfect scores except in one that the group has just put in, and it's looking at taking the budgets to a gap detail level. Only, I think, about 10 states, maybe a little more than that, have that right now. And actually, as we've talked to them about, is it really gap or is it a budget, is it detail at a level that supports the legislative direction? Orbit's, for example, going to a much more detailed level and being integrated with the accounting system. We may actually get some points for that in the next biennium. So, again, and overall, in terms of understanding budget and finance, we're ranked number 7. In the nations. So we do watch that. But again, at this point, we're not projecting targeting to going for 100% given some of those things. In terms of the detail of the budget, we used all the standard inflation rates. Again, nothing particularly exciting. We had a reduction to mass transit and a vacancy factor decreased. Again, we had little turnover this biennium. In terms of program adjustment, we had a one-time reduction this biennium that was taken out essentially out of the ending balance of the division, which translates into out of the beginning balance for the next one. And you'll see, again, a reduction of $2.5 million professional services. Again, that's the reduction for Orbitz coming out because it's a project we want to make sure every biennium is out and then is reapproved for the next biennium before we proceed.
How do you handle the budget the rotation analysts in this process? You talk about vacancy factor and turnover.
Mr. Chair, our rotation analysts are a little different than legislative fiscals. They're actually limited duration positions. So they exist there completely. It's just that they are rotated every 2 years. They are experienced positions, as they will tell you. Nobody would stay in the position because the pay is relatively low. But every 2 years, those folks that are in the position go away and then come back. So we treat them as LDs. The positions are permanent, but the analysts are hired as LDs.
I see. And so they actually are on your compensation list.
Correct.
Even though they may be coming from another department.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. All right.
Thank you.
Again, essential packages. A net other funds increase of a little over or a little under $2,000, and that's, again, just inflation and price list. If we took a 10% reduction, and this gives you a sense of what the, remembering how many staff we have permanently. Oh, I'm sorry, I went the wrong way or went too far. This gives you a sense of how much our trainee positions get paid because, again, this would be 10% of the operating budget out of our kind of 28 permanent positions. We would need to abolish one budget analyst, both of the trainee positions, an administrative staff person, and then take their reductions in associated S&S to get to that. Enhancement package, again, we've talked about this. I don't know if you have any additional questions on Orbitz, but it is the Orbitz system, and we will be looking now next at some of the ad hoc reporting. Again, further integration with the accounting system is the next phase, and as well as the functionality part of this is allowing more printing and publishing directly in the next phase. And again, it's the limited duration position authority of 9 positions and the expenditure limitation and the issuance in the next biennium of COPs. Statutory changes, we really had 2 that related to us, House Bill 2656. And what this required was in the interim, if there were substantive changes, but they didn't require the e-board action. Again, I talked about how we worked during the interim in a normal interim, that we would be bringing those forward. An example would be within an agency that has one general fund line item, but they've talked about what their program levels are going to be. If they made a really substantive change to their program levels, even though it's within administrative authority to make that change, that we would bring that forward to the legislative body, even though the e-board doesn't have to formally act on it. We do have a temporary rule in place. We haven't really had to use it because we were actually in session, and so the issues that we had this biennium we brought into every session. Although we have one kind of pending right now that will come to you, and I think we will go ahead and use it as a template of moving it through this process to see how well it works under this process. But again, the rules in place, we work with legislative fiscal to set up the definitions, and what we would propose is letting start that process, and then if we need to make changes to it or change the admin rule, we work with you on how to make that work. But again, the idea is to make sure that things don't happen in a normal 18-month period where you come back and say, wait a minute, we thought we did this, and now we're over here. The other one is, again, you've already heard about it, 3224, report of vacancies. And we do use the allotment system to do that. Agencies have to put in an allotment system at the beginning of the biennium, and then they have to report quarterly on how they're living within that allotment system. And when they do that now, they also have to include their vacancies within that system. Budget note 5502, again, on general accountability, the kinds of things. Obviously, Orbitz plays into that in terms of the kind of information that's available. House Bill 2656. The management of consistent information for special sessions, I think, was really a move by DAS to, instead of just saying to special session agencies, you just go ahead and send things directly, which has been kind of previous interims, that we really worked to make sure there was consistent direction and assumptions in place so that, again, you had accurate data. We have increased the communication on statewide fiscal issues, and again, the allotment policy processes have been tightened up and also been to that and are monitored closely. Vacancies, again, we have two right now. One is our, in effect, our process person that makes sure this all gets published, Kitsy Griffith, some of you may know, left Budget and Management and is the assistant to the Chief of Staff, and we are recruiting for that position, although we have had a frozen position as well, and we would expect that one will probably disappear in the process. This is a research analyst. I thought it was in the admin section, but we will work with Dallas to the one that's been frozen to move forward without that. And that's Budget management.
We get your walk to do, and like, and can we come back and do that tomorrow then? And then we'll be just on half a meeting behind at that point.
Sure.
With that, we will stand adjourned until tomorrow. Thank you very much.